The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
First off, I want to say how grateful we should be that we have you at Relevant Radio along with Father Rocky and all the other people that are on the radio. You do so much for us.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to Do the Drew Mariani Show. I'm on Relevant Radio. I'm Sheila Logminas. Welcome back. If you've been with me from the beginning of today's show, hours, I've had different guests on, but really about the same thing. Truth, goodness, and beauty. The human body flourishing. We talked about Simone Biles. Catherine Jean Lopez and I talked about Simone Biles, but not the medals she's won. The humanity she showed. And the fact that she was a foster care child and her grandparents adopted her and raised her and gave her a chance. But how many are out there without, we don't see their face. So the faceless and nameless children who are in need of homes and that forever home, forever family and adoption. All of that. Just talked with Dr. Charles Camosi, losing our dignity. Oh my gosh, the ways that our culture is turning into more and more of a throwaway culture, the culture of death, as you know, John Paul II called it. Pope Francis refers often to the throwaway culture. How easy is that in this consumeristic culture? But it's gotten so much worse without the human person is looked at and treated, and hospitals, ethics panels, and moral calculus about how to treat some patients, depending on their, you know, what a procedure would cost a hospital and how many years that would give the patient and what quality of life would they have. And that's a calculus. No, that's not how we do it. That's not who we are. That's not what we do. And then how do we reach out to the culture? Do we preach to the choir? Well, even the choir has to be on the same page, right, in order to sing with harmony. And that gets into the arts, and that gets into beauty, and all of this comes together in my next guest, believe it or not. Even that riff somehow comes into my next guest. Dr. Todd Warner's here, who practices medicine, writes for Bishop Robert Barron's Word on Fire Media, and serves as managing editor of Evangelization and Culture. It's the quarterly journal of Bishop Barron's Word on Fire Institute. He is always writing. He has long written, a Catholic thinker, exploring the true, the good, and the beautiful. In Alatea, he was writing a blog called Catholic Thinking that I followed for years, and now I follow his writing through Evangelization and Culture. Wonderful writing. Dr. Warner, welcome back.
Sheila, it is so good to talk to you again.
It's so good to talk with you. I know we could spend hours talking because we just get started and there's so much to cover. And I could go through all of the evangelization and cultures that I have in hand and stacked up on my desk because you write such a great column in there and you cover a wide gamut. Do you sit down and know what you, I just want to ask this quickly, and know ahead of time what you're going to write? Do you think through this and then have a plan, or do you just like see a screen and just start typing?
You know, it's kind of one of those things where I'll have an epiphany, something will come up one given day. I'll jot a few notes in my notes section on my phone. And then later on, I don't have anything really formulated, just a couple ideas. And then it just grows on the screen. And so it's kind of the Holy Spirit. And hopefully it's material that people find helpful in their faith walk.
Well, it certainly is. It's very helpful. Your column, Midnight Oil, is just always, it's filled with humor, things, a lot of meditative thoughts to contemplate. Literary references, and even political ones. You say in the current issue, in an age of anger and ideology, politics has become an all too humorless affair. So, you know, with exquisitely sensitive egos, you note, and hair trigger tempers, anyone who seeks engagement in the public square knowingly courts an element of danger. And then you cite some people and you say, we're called to great joy and limitless mirth. I love that, Todd. Be light, take heart. So, if anything, people are doing the exact opposite. People are at each other's throats. They're angry. They're blurting on social media because they can. No one need have an unuttered thought any longer. And usually it's something angry. So how do we take heart and have limitless mirth? How do we even find mirth?
You know, I it's a great question, Sheila. And I think at the end of the day, we all find our way there because we get exhausted with angst.
Right.
I think we're, you know, what's kind of sad is once upon a time, irony was kind of a part of a little bit of an edgy punchline, but it wasn't the dominant narrative of the way the world operates. And now it's sort of like to borrow from Flannery O'Connor, it's the air we breathe. I mean, she said nihilism is the air we breathe. And it's kind of the truth even now. but I think irony and cynicism, that everybody just kind of rolls their eyes. And if they're not rolling their eyes, they're jabbing their finger in someone else's chest. And at the end of the day, it's a turnoff. I mean, it's exhausting. It's mm-hmm. you know, if everything is an outrage, then you're fatigued by it. And so I think at the end of the day, it's when you come across something light, something that makes you laugh, something that distracts you from some of what seems to be the unfixables of a broken world, to some of the great joys and virtues of a broken world or in a broken world. And so it's interesting because I just saw a patient the other day who was struggling with a lot of what was going on in the world. And I said, you got to take a month off from what's going on in the world. You need to turn off your news. You need to, and I said, I want you to get a book, a poem. And I think there's great modern poetry, but I said, get a book of poetry from the 1950s, and I want you to read a poem in the morning and a poem at night. And I said, and he talked about his faith life, and I said, you need to practice your faith. And I wasn't pushing faith upon him as a patient, but I was saying, if that's a part of your life, I said, you need to engage with that for 1 month. And so he's going to take a step away and try this. But I just find that sometimes when people turn off the talking heads, turn off the anger, turn down the volume, and they actually watch their kids play, or they read something that has nothing to do with politics, or they listen to beautiful music, or just have a non-political conversation with somebody, all of a sudden their soul is rejuvenated. And it's what we all need.
It's what we all need, and it also evangelizes not only us, it elevates our hearts and minds to God, but talk about how it evangelizes other people. Because when we have encountered beauty in the arts, in literature, in art, you and I both love Caravaggio, among others, but when we see that, you can't come away untouched from a great museum with great art, from great literature. And I'm so glad that in evangelization and culture, you so often, Dr. Warner, point out great books to read, great poetry, as you just said. And you, I'm so thankful that as a doctor, you bring this not only to patients, but to medical residents that you're training. Talk about that too, because you've trained, that's the care of the human person fully. As a man of medicine, you have trained interns and medical students even, how to treat the full human person. And you've taught them through literature. And I know during 2020, right, wasn't it then? Plague literature?
Yep.
I mean, unbelievable curriculum you put together. Talk about that.
You know, one of the things I say to the students and residents, probably get tired of me saying it, but I say, you know, if you are a student only of the human body, you're going to be a good physician. But if you're a student of the human body and the human soul, you're going to be a great physician. You know, the problem with the modern scientism worldview is to break human beings down to their material parts and forget about the deeper aspects, the deeper strains that are running from within them. And so while I'm bringing a Catholic sensibility to what I teach, but I'll bring to them Yeats and Frost and Dickinson and Jane Austen and Dostoevsky and others. And when all of a sudden they encounter the Divine Comedy as the story of a person who struggles midway through their life, and having to go with the help of a director, of a mentor, through the dark depths of hell and the purgative aspects of purgatory before they arrive at a place, a higher place, the beatific vision, paradise, all of a sudden they recognize that struggle. We see that every single day in our clinic. We see that in ourselves. And so it's interesting how, and Gary Saul Morrison, in a great piece that I give to the students all the time, he wrote for Commentary called Why College Kids Are Avoiding the Study of Literature. You know, one of the things that he kind of says is, he says, there's no behavioral scientist, social scientist, or economist that ever nailed down human nature like George Eliot did on Dorothy of Brooke in Middlemarch, or Leo Tolstoy did with Anna Karenina. And why is that? Because they're enfleshed characters that walk uncertain walks. And we, as we read those stories, find ourselves in their shoes. And so the value of literature and the value of virtue and the value of understanding the human soul in the practice of medicine that transcends even the human body, that's the magic of being a physician. That's the difference between a vocation and a job, between being a physician and a technician.
You know, so then expand that. Expand on that from other people's professions or their job, which really is a profession or a vocation. It's what you do and you're called to do, and you may have a passion for it, and if you do, you know you're in the right profession. But instead of considering it a job and you go and do the work of that job, say, in my field, all my life, I've been, even when I was a little girl, I made my own newspapers. I knew I wanted to be in the media. I did. At nine, I was making my own
newspapers. I wish you had re-released re-release those. I'd want to read them now.
I think my mother saves everything that I've ever written. And I don't know if she has any of those, but at 9, I was taking the daily newspaper. And listen to this. I was cutting out the news, the written part, the news article. And I just kept the photo. And then I put it on, I glued it, I guess, to a piece of paper. And I wrote my own because I wanted to be in the media. And why? Because, Todd, that's storytelling. But I consider that in the news media, it literally is. You might be covering breaking news and investigative journalists, whatever. But ultimately, that's taking words and telling other people, this is what happened. I want to tell you the what, where, when, why, how, all of that. One of my family members says, you don't have to be so Dickensian when you tell stories. Just get to the point. Well, you know what?
You do. We need that, Sheila. We need it.
One member has to suffer through it because I can't tell a story any other way. But that gets to what I'm asking. We can all experience our experiences, as Chesterton said, but then as, oh my gosh, how will I share this with others? And then while you're experiencing it, you're thinking about how you can put this in the mind's eye and the imagination of other people. Sorry, I'm on a riff here, but this is taking off from what you said. You're a doctor. There are many doctors out there who don't do what you just described. You, because I already knew you did this. That's why I asked you. What you do for medical residents, and you help them see not just the human body, but the human body and soul and spirit, and how to come alive, how you tell a patient who's suffering to turn off the news for a while, read poetry, practice your faith. I mean, this is the fullness of your calling as a devout Catholic and as a medical doctor. So go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
No, I was taking way too long to get to the bottom line question of what I already started with. So expand that out to what you do, into what we all do, and how we can evangelize the culture in what we do.
There's nothing more infectious than people who have passion. There's nothing more infectious than that. And when you're on the radio, Sheila, when you and I are talking, you just exude passion. You can tell that you're in your vocation, you're answering your calling. And the people out there that are struggling with that, they're like, am I in the right place? Am I doing the right thing? They've got to listen to that inner call, that inner hunger. One of the pieces of career counseling I give to undergraduate, I teach at St. John's and St. Ben's, and one of the pieces of, which is in Collegeville, Minnesota, and one of the pieces of insight I give to them is to say, when you're deciding what you're going to do, you've got to be listening for the call. And when you're listening to that call, the three big questions you got to be able to answer is, to some extent, can I survive on this? Because you do have to pay the bills. Am I passionate about it? Does this move me? Mm-hmm. And the third thing is it consistent with my values? If you can answer those three questions, you're going to find yourself falling in love every day with the work you do. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't have bad days. It doesn't mean that sometimes it can't be a grind. Of course it can. But the long and the short is everybody is seeking something ennobling in their lives. Everybody's striving to have a passionate engagement. And some people, they get home and turn on Monday Night Football, and that's their passionate engagement. The issue is, what are your gifts? And how can you use those gifts in the most passionate way possible to lead other people to Christ, to lead other people to greater fullness of their own? And I think sometimes a lot of us can be sleepwalking through life. And the thing is, it's time to wake up. It's time to wake up, to drink the fullness that life has to offer, and to use the gifts God gave you so you could bring other people to identify their gifts and make the world a better place.
Well, that's so well put. My guest is Dr. Todd Warner. He, besides practicing medicine, writes for Bishop Robert Barron's Word on Fire Media and serves as managing editor of Evangelization and Culture, the actual very beautiful quarterly. It's not just a quarterly journal. It's a very, very beautiful quarterly journal of Bishop Robert Barron's Word on Fire Institute. And as I said, Todd, I love your writing in the Evangelization and Culture. So kind of what we're just talking about pivots to something I really love in the current issue that you've done. And it's your column, yes, Midnight Oil. But then further back in the magazine, it's where you do a sit-down interview with two other Word on Fire colleagues of yours. But they're in media. So, I mean, like in terms of like new media productions and things like that Word on Fire does. And in the conversation, I love that this came out because this is something that's always bothering me. How can we do what we do now better? How can pro-lifers be pro-lifers better? How can we talk about abortion and women and suffering and human life better? And that comes out in the conversation early when you say that, or he says, one of your colleagues, we're after the growing number of especially young people swept up in the currents of secular culture. unchurched, for whom maybe a more odd extra instead of an intra approach is required. Sure, we serve the faithful, of course, but for the purpose of helping them become effective evangelizers. So we don't only feature people we agree with, or that's what I think in my media world. I think, you know, that's really good in talking to people we don't agree with, but find common ground somewhere and cover issues that matter to all of us. So the problem here is that we never, it says, move forward with the mission evangelization. Rather, we look sideways. Talk about that, because you're after the very same thing I feel a passion to try to do better, is getting out there in a different way, be creative, think creatively, not get outside your, you know, think outside the box. That's kind of an overused cliche, but kind of that, really, think creatively.
Yeah, and you're speaking about, if I can say, Joe Glore and Doug Cummins, who are two absolutely outstanding bright lights in the Word on Fire ministry, who are just leading the charge in cutting edge technology, cutting edge filming, and I don't want to say thinking outside the box, but they are thinking outside the box. I mean, the great thing about our faith, and the great thing about the gifts God gave us, and especially the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, is the sky's the limit, and that we shouldn't be restrained by the notion that we have to be conventional.
Right.
God, Christ, the saints, the Holy Spirit, I mean, the Trinity, everything about our faith is unconventional. It's glorious. It's virtuous in an unvirtuous world. It's glorious in a humdrum world. And it lights the bright lights in a sea of darkness. And so the issue is, again, this is the challenge to each one of us. How many people out there are listening and are kind of saying, you know, I'm doing good at what I do. I'm living a good life. I'm involved in good things. But the issue is that I think it was Benedict XVI that said this, that we were called for greatness. We're not called to just be good. We're called for greatness. Now, I think sometimes the notion that the constant reach means you have to be perpetually dissatisfied with your accomplishments, and that's not the case. We should actually recognize the dignity of our work and get our rest that we need to get, and so on. But we should always be wanting more and reaching for more when it comes to bringing the fullness of Christ to a modern world that has an incredible amount of sadness and brokenness. You think about Christ saying to the disciples that, you know, there's few people that are out there that can gather the harvest. And so that just means that we need to recruit more people to gather the harvest with us. And once you get out there and you start doing the gathering, it is a sea of adventure. That's why Chesterton is such a fun person to read over and over again, because he's like a genius kid who never grew up. And has constant insights and constant glee and constant joy of the sun rising and falling. And what can we do different? What can we do better today for the sake of our faith?
I agree with you 100,000%. So I love Chesterton's, sometimes, I don't know, when something happens, just something very unfortunate, you think, it's like Winnie the Pooh, bother. But, you know, I can't believe this happened. Darn it. And so, but Chesterton, I love that he said, an inconvenience is an adventure wrongly understood.
An adventure
is an inconvenience rightly understood. And then he uses the example of a man, probably picturing London, right? But a man walking down the street with a top hat on and all that. And the wind blows, and it blows the hat off his head, and it goes tumbling and tumbling in front of the man down the sidewalk, and he has to run after it and chase it. And that could be, this is like a really terrible inconvenience for me right now. I have to run after this hat and hope I can catch it. No, it's what a delightful adventure this is. And I think I need to remember that every time something inconvenient happens, which who doesn't it happen to all the time? But there you go. That's the imagination. Talk about the importance of our imagination, because ideas and pictures that form in our heads, Todd, we know turn into actions that we act out. We need those ideas. We need what goes in our minds to be formed with truth, goodness, and beauty.
We all know that when Jesus says, love your neighbor as yourself, it's an extraordinary truth. But when he tells us the story of the Good Samaritan, it's jaw-dropping. And the stories that are out there that embody the human experience, that put flesh on the bones of platitudes or truths or what have you, that flesh is what keeps us going. That, you know, we cry over stories. And why do we cry over stories? Why do we laugh raucously over stories? Because we too can be that central figure in that story. We get it. We've been there. We know that. And so, again, we live, I hate to say it, in a cynical world, in an ironic world. It's an unimaginative world. Same stuff, different day. And if you have some modicum of creativity or hope in a world that doesn't want to give that any daylight, you're an oddity. And yet what's ironic is every time someone is bringing about the imaginative, bringing about the hopeful, bringing about joy in a sometimes joyless world, everybody wants to go to that fire and warm their hands by it. Everybody. And right. so we know that. And so the point is, we need to be the bearers of the light, and whatever form of skills people have out there, whatever gifts they have, whatever creativities they have, whatever imaginative use. But the point is, God says, break free and use your gifts to bring others to me. And when others are brought to Christ, it's like, this is it. It's like Dante before the beatific vision, wordless at the majesty he could never have conceived of.
Amen. I mean, and it's up to us as the original disciples to go out and tell. At the end of every Mass, you know, the Mass is in, and now go out. Go out and tell the world and spread the good news. And, you know, people don't tend to do that. I remember a priest a long, long time ago who would end the Mass and say, and by the way, don't cut each other off in the parking lot and wave your fist or whatever. And I thought, well, I mean, maybe a bit of a wit there at the end, but it's really, the focus should be go out and tell the world. It might be hard, especially right now. People don't want to be, discriminated against, bullied, because after all, that is one form of discrimination that's still accepted, right? Christians. But we shouldn't look at it that way. You can't. Joy is contagious. And you, Dr. Warner, exude joy. And so does your staff. And you do it beautifully. One of the things in this interview, and I'm going to wrap up with this, when you're talking to two of your colleagues about studio spaces and filming that will come to the aid of the new evangelization, you ask, so that's technology, that's space, that's studio, that's making film, making pictures, making visuals, and giving voice to, you know, giving airwaves, a voice on the airwaves. What will all of that mean for the new evangelization? You ask them that. What is that answer?
It's just another way to raise the bar to meet or exceed the level of what the secular world is doing to bring Catholicism to large quantities of people in the most vivid way possible. We should be, as Catholics, we should be employing every tool in the arsenal, every tool that we have to make apparent to other people the brilliance of what this faith is. And by the way, one thing I want to say is, if I can, Sheila, is that when I was talking to these guys about technology, I have no idea about cameras and boom mics and all this kind of stuff, but they turned it into a story of spirituality. And so whatever marble anybody out there is starting with, sculpt it into something beautiful for God.
Or as Michelangelo did, free the beauty inside of it into what it was meant to be. Dr. Warner, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Drew Mariani is here for you on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. I'm Sheila Logmanis in for Drew as he takes a few days off. He'll be back. Meanwhile, we've got great guests, great topics, very important topics, and you're hearing in different places about a particular Supreme Court case you don't have that much clarity on. Might it end Roe v. Wade? You've wondered, really? After all these decades, there's finally something? Haven't we heard that before? Well, we're going to clarify. The Supreme Court will be hearing the case of Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization this fall. The Attorney General for the state of Mississippi has urged the court to completely overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, companion cases. Numerous friend of the court briefs have been filed by pro-life experts and groups giving the court reasons from all kinds of different legal angles of why those two cases should be overturned. I mean, after all, they were wrongly decided in the first place, and even Justice Ginsburg said that way back in the day, but I digress. If the court decides to do that and overturn Roe, and right now it's not at all clear that that's what's going to happen, then it'll be up to the states to decide how abortion is going to be regulated, if at all. States like New York and Massachusetts have already passed legislation that would make abortion legal throughout the entire pregnancy if Roe is overturned. On the other hand, Texas recently passed a trigger law saying that abortion will be outlawed completely there if Roe is overturned. So see, it goes back to the states where it was before Roe. But the state of Louisiana went further. They changed their constitution to say that you cannot construe a right to abortion in their founding document. So they've tied judges' hands in the Pelican state so they can't find, as was done with Roe v. Wade, some esoteric right that actually isn't written. This is important because a lot of so-called red states have judges who were placed there by Republican governors, but those judges may not actually rule correctly. This happened recently in Kansas, where a pro-life law was struck down by the state Supreme Court, even though the majority had been appointed by Republican governors. Such are the times we're living in. Ryan Everson is a seminarian for the Diocese of Phoenix. Before that, he had been an editor for Alliance Defending Freedom, the president of Phoenix Pro-Life Future, as well. He recently wrote about this whole story in Public Discourse. It is so good to have you here, Ryan. Thanks for coming in and talking about this important, important case.
Sheila, my pleasure. Great to be with you today.
So what happened in Kansas? Why did the state Supreme Court strike down a pro-life law, even though the majority had been appointed by Republican governors? Don't people think that's kind of a given, that they're going to go pro-life?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. It's a great question. So basically, Kansas has a system for appointing judges that is different than the federal system. So in the federal system, a president says, I want this person on the Supreme Court, the Senate confirms, and we're done. In Kansas, the governor has to choose from judges who are approved by the state bar organization. And the state bar organizations have been pro-abortion for decades. So the state bar will give the governor a list of candidates, all of whom support Roe v. Wade in some circumstances. And that's the best the governor can do, no matter how pro-life he is. So Republican governors and pro-life governors in Kansas were unable to appoint pro-life judges and originalist judges who interpreted the Constitution as it should be. And as a result, Kansas was unable to ban abortion in the second trimester, even though it should have been able to.
Mm. Well, this is happening all over the country. So tell us what happens. What's the Missouri plan as we go sort of crisscross different states?
Mm-hmm. So the Missouri plan is this method of judicial appointments where the state bar or a similar organization gets to decide or influence who a governor can appoint to state courts, including the state Supreme Court. So like I said, this prevents governors from appointing pro-life judges, judges who interpret the text of the Constitution, the state constitutions as they are actually written, and it forces them to appoint judges who affirm Roe. And there is many states who are pro-life demographically and pro-life in public policy who, if Dobbs is decided in our favor, would not be able to appoint judges, have not been able to appoint judges who will rule in favor of life. And as a result, many pro-life states will not be able to have pro-life laws because they will be struck down by the state courts that have these progressive activist judges.
And I want to tell people that your Public Discourse article, Ryan, is headlined or titled, Dobbs, the Supreme Court case, won't fix state courts. To do that, pro-life lawmakers must step up now. So if this U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe and Casey, this means that issue, as we said, the issue goes back to the states. But if this isn't addressed properly by the states, as you point out in your Public Discourse article, we could end up with a majority of states having pro-abortion laws, right? Do you see it that way?
Oh, absolutely. So there's about a dozen states that, as I said, are pro-life in terms of public policy and demographic, but have some version or variation of this Missouri plan system. And those about dozen or so states are in danger of not being able to pass pro-life laws or enact pro-life laws, even though they are pro-life demographically.
So in your article, the little pull quote or the blurb at the top before you even get into your article says, so it's from the article, in some states, it's almost impossible for pro-life governors to appoint originalist judges, Ryan. That's why we, pro-lifers, must pursue state-level judicial reforms before Dobbs is decided to make the most. So how's that going? How's that project going? Is we at the state level must pursue state level judicial reforms before Dobbs is decided in the Supreme Court?
Right. So that's a project I'm kind of trying to bring to people's attention with this article I wrote because it's being missed in a lot of the public discussion on this Supreme Court case. So there's 11 key states, as I mentioned before, where we should be trying to address this, where the state is pro-life, but they have this bad Missouri court judicial nomination system. So those states, if you're in one of those states, are Arizona, Florida, Indiana, Iowa, Missouri, Nebraska, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Tennessee, Utah, and Wyoming. So if you're in one of those states, I would encourage you to do is contact your state legislators at your state capitol. And if you have a state policy organization that is pro-life, to contact them, encourage them to read up on this and reform their state constitution so that you can pass the pro-life laws that your people want to pass in your state.
I'll tell you, when you said South Dakota, that was startling because going back, 2005 or 2006, I worked with a constitutional law expert who really helped the folks of South Dakota draft and then pass the most comprehensive and best to date, and maybe best ever, informed consent law about abortion. And that informed consent law should stand as the model for all the states, but at least it does in South Dakota, because it is so beautifully written, so eloquently written. They went to great lengths to do all the work ahead of time before writing that law, because they knew how many attacks they were going to get, how much pushback they were going to get legally in the court system. And they did, from NARAL and Planned Parenthood and the ACLU and others. And they did. They were in and out of courts for a long time until finally they won to the degree where it was a done deal. It was set, put into law. But it merely states that when a woman is pregnant and goes to her doctor, first of all, he's treating two patients. And then it says that a baby is not going to come into existence when a woman's pregnant and goes to an abortion clinic and seeks to remove a blob of tissue, as they're often told, that the human being is already present in her womb. That is part of the law in South Dakota, to inform the woman, in the first fully informed consent law in the country, to tell the woman that she is already carrying a fully present, unique, separate, living human being, as part of the language, in her womb. And that when the doctor does the procedure, he will be ending the life of that fully formed, unique, separate, living human being in her womb, and so forth. These are things a woman needs to know. And also what it often leads to, in a high percentage of cases, all sorts of, whether it's depression, physical ailments, mental health ailments, even suicide ideation, that's all in there. And so, of course, they ran to court, Ryan, claiming Planned Parenthood and the abortion industry, that violates the doctor's free speech rights. And for a little while, that worked. But, I mean, this is what people are up against. So what's the problem in South Dakota that this is now back again, one of the states in play?
Right. So a lot of states enacted this Missouri fan system a long time ago because it was seen as a way to make the judicial nominations less political. And in a different world where things work differently, maybe it would work okay. But the reality is that the state bar organizations, like many of our higher educational institutions, have become progressively more and more and more pro-abortion. Laws like the one you just mentioned in South Dakota are oftentimes safe because those are not do not restrict abortion as much as an all-out ban. But even laws like that could be in trouble in South Dakota, because if Roe were to fall, then NARAL, Planned Parenthood, and their friends would begin challenging these things in state courts and bringing forth new legal arguments in state courts that they haven't brought forth before. And the state court judges who have been basically vetted by these pro-abortion state bar organizations could say, you know what, we decide that the South Dakota Constitution supports and defends the right to abortion because insert bad reason here, which is exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court did in Roe.
Yeah, well, insert bad reasons here. So to that point, when I made that reference to Justice Ginsburg, as a quick aside, I mean, I remember years and years ago when journalist Tim Carney put together a list of people who were self-identified pro-choice, pro-abortion supporters. They certainly wanted the right to abortion to be kept legal. And they were, and not only were they that, but they were notable people who believed in the right to abortion. And one of them was Justice Ginsburg, and one of them was a former legal clerk who clerked for Justice Blackmun. I mean, the father of Roe v. Wade, and many others who were then former legal clerks, Ryan, and went on to become kind of big name in the court systems in constitutional law, whether academics, practicing law, judges, and so on. And to a person, it came down to, at the very least, they said, while they wanted abortion to remain legal, Roe was wrongly decided law. And to varying degrees, some of them actually took that out further and said a lot more about Roe, how badly decided it was, how badly written it was. So they just kind of created or fabricated the right to abortion out of whole cloth. And just, put privacy under the right to privacy. Now you have the right to do this. So we have to learn the language too, right? I mean, and take that back and make that part of the pro-lifer's mission. And we just have an awfully big agenda out there for pro-lifers. The number here is 888-914-9149. You pro-lifers who want more of a mission than you're already on. Talk to Ryan Everson about his piece about what's going to happen one way or the other when the Supreme Court decides on Dobbs, because it's not going to fix the state courts. Recall the state courts, what he said, how important it is that state courts are very vital, because that's where, if this does happen at the Supreme Court, that's where this is going to go, back to the state court level. So the number 888-914-9149. Texas, Ryan, passed a trigger law outlawing abortion if Roe is overturned. That'll most likely be challenged. Will it survive that challenge, do you think?
That's a really, really interesting question. So Texas took a unique approach with their law that hasn't really been tried before. So that remains to be seen, because we don't have any precedents to tell us where that's going to go. I will say, though, that Texas does not have the Missouri plan. Texas has a good model for appointing judicial nominations. So the governor of Texas and past governors of Texas have been able to appoint judges who interpret the Texas Constitution faithfully. So gratefully, that's not a problem we'll have to worry about in Texas. And if that law is struck down, Texas will be able to pass a different law that bans abortion the exact same way. So that's a good thing to be grateful for.
Yeah, it's good to have any laws, success in the challenges we face in any court system, any number of ways. I mean, some of them are Born Alive, Abortion Survivors Protection Act. Others are pain-capable fetal, pro-lifers don't use the term fetal, pain-capable unborn children's protection act. Others are parental notification laws. I mean, any victory that can be found by pro-lifers, they're aiming for, because that's just incrementally how pro-lifers have to work on this. It's just so gargantuan to overturn Roe. Therefore, what's your prognostication about this case, Dobbs? And I know your article is, don't focus so much on Dobbs. It won't fix state courts. What we got to do is focus on state courts. But what do you think about the Dobbs case?
Yeah, so there's basically three ways that Dobbs can come out. There's two win scenarios and one loss scenario. The law scenario is the Supreme Court says Mississippi's 15-week law violates the Constitution under Roe, and we're keeping Roe. There's a big win option, a second option, where the Supreme Court says Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey were wrongly decided, we're throwing them out, states can do their own thing as far as abortion is concerned. And then there's a lower win scenario where the Supreme Court says Mississippi's 15-week law is okay. Other states can pass 15-week laws, but we're not allowing anything prior to 15 weeks yet. We're going to save that question for another day in another case. I think the most likely scenario is, that last option. I don't think the Supreme Court, based on their past decisions and some narrow decisions they had last term, I don't think they're going to overturn Roe. I think they're going to find a way to rule in Mississippi's favor without overturning it. But I'm praying every day that they do overturn Roe. And our God is a God of miracles, and we certainly should be praying and be hopeful.
Ryan, for a very long time now, pro-lifers have seen different court cases as being maybe the one that's finally going to make its way to the Supreme Court and overturn Roe. And some pro-life cases have made their way to the Supreme Court, but they've never even approached the level of overturning Roe. Why do you think there's so much hope on this case being the one, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization?
That's a great question. So there's been several smaller abortion cases at the Supreme Court over the years, the most recent being June Medical 2 years ago.
Right.
This is the first case since Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 93 that challenges Roe directly, head on. And as you said earlier in the intro, the Mississippi Attorney General directly asked the court to overturn Roe. So that's the first reason to be hopeful. Another reason that I think we should be hopeful is that there are 9 justices on the Supreme Court. It takes 4 of those 9 to accept the case and say, we're going to hear oral arguments for this case and decide it. Normally, 4 justices will not vote to hear a case unless they're pretty confident they have a 5th vote to rule the way they want that case to go. But somewhere between 70% and 80% of cases that the Supreme Court hears are reversed. The lower court ruled against Mississippi, so statistically, there's a 70% to 80% chance at least that the Supreme Court is going to reverse the lower court and uphold Mississippi's law. So those are some reasons to be hopeful.
Yeah, there have been a lot of reasons to be hopeful, and then pro-lifers, a lot of their hopes have been dashed, but then this is something new. This is a new case, and they'll take it up anew. And the other thing that's oh, who knows? It's one of those big question marks out there, and a mystery is the makeup of this court. So many people think, oh, finally, there's a majority on the court now more likely to overturn Roe. And yet it's been kind of mysterious at times, Chief Justice Roberts' rulings on certain cases and some of the others. So some people feel just like at the state court level, when, you know, in the setup and in our conversation, in my intro and our conversation, we've talked about Republican governors appointing judges, and same thing with Republican presidents when the Republican Party had a pro-life platform. And so you would think these governors who themselves ran on pro-life platforms would appoint pro-life judges. But, you know, then it comes down to what the case is, how it's challenging the law, how the law is being applied in that case, and not really whether a particular judge or justice is pro-life or not. We'll talk more about that, Ryan, and your time with Alliance Defending Freedom, what you learned from that, working with Phoenix Pro-Life Future. You've got firsthand experience from the pro-life world of working out there on the front lines, and from your article in Public Discourse. Ryan Everson on pro-life and the future. Speaking of Phoenix Pro-Life Future, we're going to talk about the pro-life future next.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. Drew's out today. He's on vacation right now, taking some time off, badly needed time off. We all have that. And I'm happy to be in, talking with my guest, Ryan Everson, a seminarian for the Diocese of Phoenix. Before that, he had been an editor for Alliance Defending Freedom and the president of the Phoenix Pro-Life Future. He recently wrote about what we're talking about right now, the case going before the Supreme Court that a lot of pro-lifers, many pro-lifers, hope will finally overturn Roe v. Wade. And many people feel it will. They're kind of ballparking it as the case that will finally overturn Roe v. Wade. But my guest, Ryan Everson, wrote a piece in the Public Discourse titled Dobbs, because the case is dubbed Dobbs. The Dobbs case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, which the Supreme Court will hear this fall. And the Attorney General for the state of Mississippi has urged the court to completely overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey because of when they hear this. A lot of friend of the court briefs have been filed by pro-life experts and pro-life groups giving the court reasons from all kinds of different legal angles and why they should overturn those two cases. If the court decides to do that, what we're talking about, and it's not at all clear they will, then it would be up to the states, as it was before Roe, to decide how abortion is going to be regulated in their state. My guest, Ryan Everson, wrote for the Public Discourse an article titled Dobbs, This Case, Won't Fix State Courts. To do that, pro-life lawmakers must step up now. So, Ryan, I want to pluck out this part of it, because we talked about the Missouri plan, but for people who just tuned in and are just hearing this conversation, by the way, phones are open, 888-914-9149, because Ryan ran quickly through a list of 11 key states that are kind of at play out there and how their state, your state, constitutions go and how your state laws are right now and if they're in play to be changed by a governor who was newly elected. So what's going on out there? The number is 888-914-9149 if you're in one of those states or you have a question for Ryan. So you say in the article that when the Supreme Court decided to grant the hearing for Dobbs versus Jackson's Women Health Organization, this case about overturning Roe v. Wade or not, and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, both of them involved in this case. Yeah, that case could allow states to protect life at 15 weeks gestation or perhaps as early as conception, free from federal interference. You say, but a lot of the Dobbs discussion presumes that a favorable ruling would allow state legislatures to protect life without any interference at all from the judicial branch of government, just to recap. So I wanted to ask you this earlier. I'll ask you now. While a favorable ruling from the Supreme Court in Dobbs, meaning, okay, we're going to overturn Roe, would bind all federal courts applying the federal constitution, it wouldn't bind state courts applying their state constitutions. A lot of people don't think about their state constitutions, Ryan. Consequently, you write, after Dobbs, some pro-life states will try to enact additional protections for the most vulnerable among us, only – to find their hands tied once again by state courts doing exactly what the Supreme Court did in Roe, ruling that the state constitution protects the right to abortion for any variety of absurd, progressive, consequentialist reasons you write. How do people go about changing their state constitutions?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's basically two ways for the states that have this plan that are pro-life to address it. The first way is to pass an amendment that explicitly clarifies that the state constitution does not protect a right to abortion. This is what the state of Louisiana did immediately after the Kansas case was decided in 2019. Louisiana legislators had a strong majority of both Republicans and Democrats who voted to pass this amendment saying there's no right to abortion in the state constitution. They passed it. It went to the voters to sign off on it last November. The voters signed off on it. So now the state of Louisiana is not going to have this problem if Dobbs is decided. There's many other states that could do the same. 2A, there's kind of a 2A and 2B for the second route, which has to do with the Missouri plan, which, as we discussed before, is a system for state judicial nominations where the governor cannot appoint who he wants. The governor has to take a list of people nominated by the pro-abortion state bar organizations and choose from them, so the governor can't appoint someone who is against Roe v. Wade. So 2A to address this is to abolish the Missouri plan by amending the state constitution and implement a new plan where the governor gets to pick who he wants or some other system that just isn't the Missouri plan. There's lots of systems out there. The Missouri plan is the worst one. The most important thing is that they just get rid of that. 2B, for states that don't have the votes to amend the state constitution, but maybe have a simple majority to just pass a law, is what they could do is they could reform the Missouri plan. So, for example, in Kansas, which is one of these issue states, as we discussed, 5 of the 9 seats on the Judicial Commission are controlled by the pro-abortion state bar. You could pass a law with just a simple majority that says, you know, the Constitution, state Constitution says we have to give the state bar some piece of the pie, but instead of giving them 5 of 9 seats, we're only going to give them 3 of 9 seats. And the other 6 are going to be people who we can trust to allow the pro-life governor to do what he or she wants.
Well, wow. I mean, there's a lot to this that a lot of people aren't aware of. Pro-lifers aren't even aware of a lot of what you write here in this article. When you say get rid of the Missouri plan, and again, you just clarified it once again, but just to reiterate, that under the Missouri plan, a governor can't, the key what you just said, a governor can't appoint who he or she wants. It's a commission that does. So we need to get rid of the Missouri plan or reform it. How do we go about that?
I think the best thing for people to do is, if they're in one of these key states, is to contact their state legislators about this issue. And if you have a state policy organization that is pro-life and engages with the legislature on pro-life issues, send to them. Or if you know pro-life leaders who are just even remotely involved, maybe send to them. And if you don't know the people to contact, they will know who to contact. So again, the key states here are Arizona, Florida, Indiana, Iowa, Missouri, Nebraska, Oklahoma, South Dakota, Tennessee, Utah, and Wyoming. So those are the 12 key pro-life states where the Missouri plan is in place, and they could be in trouble after a win in Dobbs if they don't address the Missouri plan and reform it.
You know, that's interesting that of the 11 you just named, most of them are in the Midwest. I mean,
definitely.
Is there a reason for that? I mean,
I think just legislators geographically in the same part of the country are sometimes friends with each other. Missouri is where the plan first started in 1940. So a lot of neighboring states jumped on the bandwagon with the same plan, which was not terrible to begin with. Abortion was illegal almost everywhere at the time. But over time, as the state bar organizations have become more and more pro-abortion, it's become more and more of an issue. And so those states have been in more trouble and will be in more trouble, particularly if we get a win in Dobbs and their hands are tied by this terrible system.
Yeah, it is a terrible system. A pull quote in your article is, in many states, including Kansas, it can be dicey, if not impossible, for a pro-life governor to nominate originalist judges. I mean, a really active person in the pro-life world can look at that and say, all right, well, then for crying out loud, what do we do? And you've been telling people that. But dicey, if not impossible, for a pro-life governor to nominate originalist judges. Can't governors, I mean, I have a very activist governor in my state who, like this, the governor of New York issued, and well, the legislature did, and then he signed it, but he wanted it, one of the most aggressive pro-abortion laws in the country, because he wants this state to be an abortion mecca, and so does the governor of New York. But I mean, when you have a governor with that kind of ability, it seems to me, Ryan, that they should have more ability on this, on appointing judges. Not so?
Oh, they absolutely should have more ability to appoint judges. And in my view, they should have the same power that the president has, which is to name who they want, and then the Senate has to appoint it. There's a little bit of checks and balances, as we often have in our great American constitutional system. But the governor gets to have the first word, and speak who he wants to have. The people have voted him into, him or her into office and trust him.
Right.
So my favorite method is where the governor gets to pick who he wants and the Senate has to approve, and that's it. There's no state bars. There's no pro-abortion organizations who are automatically given a seat at the table, nothing like that.
Wow. You know, I've always wanted to be, I want to be a journalist, number one, all my life, but I also wanted to be a lawyer. And so when I see cases like this, I just think, oh my gosh, I'd rather be a journalist covering law. But you've done a great job of covering this and in your pro-life work and your work with Alliance Defending Freedom. Ryan Everson, thank you.